episode of the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Chris Young, and joining with me as usual is Dan Roth. Dan, what's going on, buddy?
Good evening.
Yes, and we also have Sam Abula. Sam, what's up?
Hey, guys. How's it going today?
All right. We are ready to kick off the 125th episode of the podcast. Pretty excited about that. We've got quite a bit to talk about, so we're going to rush through the Autoblog Garage. Sam, you always have something. What do you have?
Got a new Mazda 6, four-cylinder, six-speed manual. Pretty nice ride.
What's its sticker at?
I'm not sure. I haven't seen the Monroney. I'll have to look it up. My boss grabbed it the other day, and I haven't seen it yet.
Okay. Is it well-appointed, or is it kind of a base model?
Yeah, it's pretty well-appointed. It's got the nav system. Not sure if it's a real leather or faux leather interior, but it's a leather-like interior.
Leatherette.
Well, you know, whatever it is, it appears to be like leather.
It's leatherette, right? Yeah.
Well, it may be. I don't know. I'll have to look up the specs. I just got it this afternoon, so I'm not sure. It's you know, got sunroof, power, pretty much everything. And it's a nice ride. Handles well. Steering's a little on the light side, maybe, but I'm quite pleased with it so far.
Now, I had the 3.7 version, and the steering wasn't bad on that one. I don't know. I mean, basically, everybody has their own opinion on steering, but the one thing I found odd about it was the dashboard materials. There are two different materials on the driver's side and the passenger side. On the passenger side, it was hard, and then it was soft around the driver's side.
Yeah, the area on the top of the airbag is soft touch material, and then pretty much everything else is hard. So I mean, the graining and everything looks the same, but when you touch it, you see that on the passenger side, it is soft to the touch, and everywhere else is hard to the touch, except for like the tops of the door panels and the armrests on the doors. Everything else is hard plastic. And, you know, it looks nice enough, and as long as you don't touch it, it's fine. So, and, you know, I mean, how often do you really touch your dashboard, you know, other than, you know, when you get into a press car and you're trying to see, okay, is it hard plastic or soft plastic? It doesn't look cheap, you know, so that's the main thing.
Right. And then it's nice that Mazda's going out of their way to actually have an up-level four-cylinder model with lots of amenities and a stick, which a lot of automakers don't do.
You know, a lot of automakers don't even offer a stick at any price point or trim level. So, you know, the fact that you're able to get one in a midsize sedan like that is definitely a plus in my book.
Zoom, zoom.
Absolutely.
All right, Dan, now what do you have this week?
Just got a BMW 128i coupe today. And, you know, our man Paukert, I have to... I guess give him credit as much as it pains me to do so, because he's been praising the virtues of convertibles. And last week I had a mini convertible, and I grew to the point where, okay, I dig it. I'm not typically a fan of the convertibles, but we've had a run of nice weather here. And so, okay, I get it. I like having the top down and it's, you know, a tight enough convertible. It does its convertible thing. Cool.
Did you have the silly goofy grin on your face while you were driving around with the top down?
No, because it was bright red, so I was kind of like trying to hide.
With the top down, great idea.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm short, so I just kind of cranked that seat way down. You know, Sam even said, you know, like, yeah, something about not being able to see over the dashboard, so whatever.
What's with the giant speedometer? I can't see anything.
And, you know, the one series I've kind of gone on record as not being tremendously... thrilled with it in terms of styling. They do drive beautiful, and I'd be the first to admit that, and you don't have to see how ugly they are from the inside. But this coupe, man, it's white, it's got a red and black leather interior, it's the 128, but it's got plenty of snort, and man, I like it. I really, really dug it. And I hate the fact that I've basically just totally reversed and I've, you know, I guess I'm just wishy-washy.
The thing with the 1 Series, though, is it's within 100 pounds of a 3 Series. So
if it's gonna
be the same, you know, virtually the same weight, you know, but have a lot less room inside, what's the point? Why not just get a 3?
And they're still charging a lot, but...
Yeah, this thing stickers at 40... No, this thing, it's, I got the Monroney in it. It's 42.
Oh my God. And you look, yeah. The last car I would ever buy, if I had $42,000, the last one would be the 128i.
But see, you see, here's the thing though, like, the, and I haven't really done any direct comparison, but the line from BMW and the fans is, okay, you get a 128 or even a 135 that stickers out at whatever. You can't get a comparable 3 Series with that powertrain and those options for the same price, you know, so it's still
cheaper. Well,
what kind of
options have you got in that 128?
Oh, this thing's got iDrive and nav and all that stuff. It's, I just drove it on the way home today, so, you know, but it's got leather. Do they all have leather? I don't know. It's got an automatic, which probably costs a chunk of change on a BMW. You know, it's got stuff.
Seriously, but you're paying like $3,000 for nav and iDrive right there. Yeah. I mean, that's not reasonable.
No,
at all.
It's obscene money. But the thing is, though, like, and here's my idea about it is, the 1 Series is what the 3 should be. When you look at the, like, the classic 3 Series cars, you had like the E30s. And they're about the same size as the 1 Series. And then the 3 Series that we have now.
At that size, it should be a good 400 or 500 pounds lighter at the least.
You know, the old 3 Series were more than 400 pounds lighter, so...
Yeah, there's no way you're going to get a car that light anymore, especially from a European automaker. They're just... they're full of safety gear. They're just like gusseted to the hilt to perform well in crash tests. It's just not going to happen when you base the 1 Series off the 3 Series architecture. There's very little weight savings you can do there.
So think about my original point. What is the point? I mean, why bother to have that car if you're not going to save any weight? All you're doing is losing interior volume and
getting uglier. It gets uglier.
Arguably, the aesthetics. You know?
I don't know exactly, although they seem to drive with a little bit more edge than the threes. That's a really unscientific comment.
Right, and I think the point to your point earlier that you didn't like it before and you're kind of liking it now, it's just a lot of it has to do with mood. So I mean, you're in a better mood, the weather's nicer. I don't know, spring usually makes me feel a little bit more like an optimist, though not this spring. But
it's a color combo that I like. You know, I I've always liked the way they drive because they're essentially a 3 Series. And the 3 Series, while they're pretty hideous except for the coupe, they drive really, really nicely. That's BMW's thing.
I mean, you know, I can't argue with you there, Dan, because I mean, when I drove the 123D last summer, you know, it certainly drives great. But, mm-hmm. you know, I guess, you know, my point is, it certainly a 3 Series can be made to drive just as well, and you know, at least, you know, for the same weight, you're getting some usable interior volume, which you don't have in the 1.
Right. Your point is valid. Nobody's arguing it.
The price difference goes out the window when you start pricing a 128. I mean, it starts at 29.
Right, but the difference
so does
is about,
a 3 Series.
Right. Well, I think it starts at 32, doesn't the 3 Series?
Well, maybe.
Yeah, probably.
It's okay, within a couple thousand dollars, and I would rather
The difference between 29-something, it's not 29 even, it's 29 and change, and 32,000 is, like, what, $3,000? Come on.
You know what you get is a very well-loaded G37 for 42,000, and you'd be a much happier human being.
Actually,
for that kind of money, you know, for 44, I would actually prefer to take the 335D. With the new diesel engine, and then, you know, take the $1,000 tax credit, you're down to 43, you know, and that thing's pretty nicely equipped at that price point. Gets great fuel economy. It's faster than a 128, and, you know, you're back to that, you know, you've actually got a usable back seat.
I am not at all
comfortable. Sort of usable.
I am not comfortable with Sam pushing diesels. This is new territory. I don't know what to do with that.
All right,
He's on the Bosch payroll.
Yeah, let's get, definitely need to get out of the garage. I don't have anything again this week. Nothing? Big surprise. All right.
Well, when you do have something, what's coming? Anything good? Should we just tease it? You know?
The first vehicle I have, I get May 20th, is the 335D, and then I get the, oddly enough, and then I get the
MK. Did Sam line that one up for you?
Yeah, no. I just got lucky. And then I've got the MKZ. So those are the next two that I've got in May. So, all right.
Excellent.
Let's start with. I'm going to skip some of the industry news because GM and Chrysler both had a lot of big news this week. But
They both shut down. They're finished. So let's move on.
No. Okay. So we'll start with some auto news. Sam, you drove the Chevy Volt Mule, and you just put up a post on it. And I'm sure everybody, at the time you're reading this, you'll have already or hearing this. You'll have already read it. So kind of give us a little background on what happened with the Volt Mule.
Yeah, basically, these are the second generation Volt Mules. The first ones were the so-called Malivolts that we saw about a year ago that were based on the previous generation Malibu body shell. This time around, they built about 30 second-gen cars that are based on a Cruze. And since the Volt is going to be based on the same platform as the Cruze, this is a lot closer to the final car. You know, it doesn't look like what the Volt is going to look like. Some would argue that it actually looks better than the production Volt. The Cruze is definitely a sharp car, and I think people will be very pleasantly surprised when they get a chance to drive it. The interior was really nice, but these particular Cruzes that we drove today have the full Volt powertrain in there with the range extender, the 16 kilowatt hour, 40 mile battery pack, and drove it for about 10 miles or so, 10, 12 miles around a loop around the GM Tech Center in Warren. And it worked really well. Everything seemed to work just fine. So there was no big surprises. I mean, it basically drove like any other of the electric cars that I've driven. Silent, smooth. You know, obviously, you know, there's no transmission, so no shifting or anything. It didn't do anything funky. It just, you know, accelerated away smoothly and fairly briskly as well. So, you know, if this is at all representative of what we can expect when the Volt comes out, I think, assuming that it's priced at a point where people can actually afford to buy one, then, you know, I think it'll do pretty well.
Now, did you notice it was heavy? Was it, was it more enjoyable than you thought? It was going to be less enjoyable?
The cars we drove are just a little bit heavier than what the production cars will be, the production Volts. It's heavier than a standard Cruze, but it didn't feel particularly heavy. You know, most of the extra weight is from the 400-pound battery pack, which is mounted, you know, low, you know, on the floor in the center tunnel of the car. So it's right down the middle of the car and low in the car. So the center of gravity is actually a little bit lower than on a standard Cruze. So the car corners really flat. They didn't have the final ride and handling calibrations, obviously, on this vehicle, nor did we really get a chance to evaluate it all that hard. But, you know, I mean, it accelerated just fine. 0-60 is going to be like 8.5 seconds on the Volt. And, you know, this felt pretty close to that. So, you know, I don't think anybody will have any complaints. You know, it's certainly not a golf cart. Yeah, it doesn't move like a golf cart. So,
I think 60 and 8.5 seconds is perfectly respectable.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's fine for, you know, a mainstream car, mainstream four cylinder compact sedan. So,
now, as far as the powertrain combination, was it the 1.4, the whole nine yards, or was it just running?
It had the engine in there, but for purposes of this drive, it didn't do. The range extender never came on. We just drove it in EV mode. So, you know, all we saw was the running off the battery. They're planning another drive, probably in about 2 months or so when, it'll be a longer drive, you know, so we'll get a chance to see what it's like when the range extender comes on. And that'll probably be with starting the end of, around the end of May. They're going to be building 75 of these integration prototypes, which are, you know, with the full Volt body shell, you know, all the parts built off of production or close to production tooling. So it'll be a fully representative car And that's probably what the next drive will be with, is those, what they call Iver prototypes, integration vehicles.
So, now, I'm looking at the photo right now of the kind of like the cutout of the Volt, where you can see the insides. Uh-huh. And on the side, it looks like there's a radiator on the sides of the bumper. What is that?
Hold on, let me get to that photo.
It's got here. I could actually send it to you real quick. It's got the.
It actually looks like a control unit of some type.
No, that's a heat exchanger of some sorts.
Is that for the batteries? Maybe.
That might be the battery heat exchanger. Yeah. Yeah, I think that is.
Okay.
But I'm not 100% certain on that.
Well, it seems like it's going to try to keep the batteries at a stable temperature, so it'll warm them and cool them when it needs
to. Right. The battery pack is liquid cooled, so the control system will moderate the temperature of the whole pack to keep it, you know, within its optimal operating range. That's one of the keys to trying to make the battery last for 10 years. And then, you know, other things, when it's cold outside, you know, when you have the car plugged in to charge, it'll warm up the battery. So the battery, you know, again, as soon as you unplug it, it's already at optimum operating temperature. So you can just pull up, because, you know, batteries, you know, if you've ever been outside in cold weather and you've got your cell phone in your pocket and it gets cold, you know, when you pull it out, you know, you notice you have little or no battery power in your cell phone.
Right.
Batteries don't like cold temperatures. So they'll pre-warm the battery, or, you know, if you live in Phoenix in July, you know, it'll cool the battery, you know, while it's sitting there charging, so that it's always at its optimum temperature.
Okay, let's move on to more news, and keep us updated on that, obviously, when you get to the next drive. Also, Ford Fusion Hybrid travels 1,000 miles with one-third of a tank left. Kind of a cool thing Ford did is they're going on a nice little trip to see how far they can go in the Fusion Hybrid, and they've got none other than NASCAR's Carl Edwards as the driver for this little experiment. Dan, what do you guys think about this whole publicity stunt, and how feasible is it to get 1,000 miles in real life?
Not at all. Yeah, I don't agree with the practice of hypermiling in any form. I think it's stupid. It's really a parlor trick. You're driving incredibly dangerous. The hardcore hypermilers do things like try to draft semis, and they roll through stop signs and things like that. It's just not worth it.
Have you guys seen the Carl Edwards crash video from Talladega?
The one where it went into the stands? Is that
him that crashed at Talladega?
Yeah, it was him. Carl Edwards was the guy who was right behind him. Is a long name, starts with a K, John K. Well, I don't know NASCAR, and I'm proud of it, but
nothing wrong with that,
right? So this guy is this is the part that I thought was so ironic, is he was right on Edwards' ass the entire time, and I'm thinking, and they call it in my video game, they call it slipstreaming, and I'm like, he's slipstreaming, and then basically he goes to make his move, Edwards goes to cut him back off. Since he was hypermiling behind him, he was able to get the draft and push ahead, and then Edwards too late tried to come back over to block him. And that's how the accident started. So, you know, then 2 days later, he's doing it to other people.
Yeah. I mean, it's impressive that it went 1,000 miles on a tank, and it actually went up to, what was it, like 1,400 something before 1400, they finally ran it dry?
Yeah, I think it was 1,445 was the final tally.
It's still incredible. Yeah. It's incredible no matter what you say.
That's awesome, but I mean, the practices you use to get there.
Yeah. It's. You know, it's nerve-wracking. It takes all your concentration to drive that way. You know, it's not something that you should be doing on a regular basis. I mean, there's elements of it that, you know, normal drivers can use, you know, under normal circumstances, you know, to just drive more efficiently. But, you know, driving like that, you know, you'll get to maybe, you know, you'll get into that 40 mile per gallon range, but you're sure not going to get to, you know, the 80 miles per gallon that these guys were doing. Plus, you know, the other thing to consider, too, is once you get past about 40 miles per gallon, you know, the miles per gallon it's not a linear function, you know, in terms of how much fuel you use.
And it really depends on the route more so than anything else at that point.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's part of it, too.
It's a reverse hockey stick. right? So yeah. The hockey stick is very high at the beginning, and then it drops down, and as you go down, like when you get to 80 miles per gallon, the angle is much less steep than it is at 20 to 30. Is that what you're right. saying?
Yeah, I mean, you know, every time you double the fuel, double the MPGs, the amount of fuel that you save is cut in half. So, you know, going from 20 to 40 miles per gallon, you know, you might save, you know, certain amount of fuel over a certain distance, but going from 40 to 80, you're only going to save half that amount of fuel. So you get diminishing returns. Yeah, I mean, if you get to 40, you're getting certainly most
not,
of your savings.
Yeah. It's certainly not worth the safety and common sense cost of some of these extreme hypermiling right. practices.
Plus,
and
you know, the other thing is, these guys, I think the average for that 1,400 miles was something like just over 20 miles an hour. The average
yeah,
speed.
Okay, fine. Look, I mean, my lawnmower can get like 100 miles to per gallon traveling at 2 miles an hour, too. I mean, whatever. You know, yeah, it's kind of a parlor trick. It's very cool. It's very good that they'll be able to use it in their advertising. I think that's something I'd like to see finally is a car as good as the Fusion, as good as the Fusion Hybrid, which is probably the most competitive thing in that segment, you know, from Ford, from an American manufacturer. I think that's great. And I think the car deserves every accolade it gets. And Ford would be silly to not do something with it like this. So yeah, that's good. It makes me cringe every time you get somebody on TV or radio saying, well, pretend there's an egg under the accelerator. No. Shut up now. NPR sent their person who doesn't ever drive a car to come talk to you, and you're going to spew your whatever all over all the airwaves, and you're going to get all these people in their Priuses, and they're you know, hypermiling in front of me in the left lane, talking on their cell phone, driving very dangerously.
As usual, Dan has no opinions and, you know,
no. It's just, you know, drive efficiently, yes, but driving stupid on, you know, you can drive stupid very fast, or you can drive stupid to try to get really exceptional fuel mileage. Either way, it's stupid, and it's putting everybody around you in danger. You know, so
There you have it. But I think, you know, at first I thought, why Carl Edwards? This doesn't make any sense. It's not like he's going fast. But then it kind of hit me, you know, you know, these guys are trying to sell, you know, Fusions to NASCAR fans, and this is a
great
doesn't
way to
his, do
isn't, don't they have
does
a Fusion
he drive a
car
Ford
of tomorrow?
Car?
Yes, he is. He's a Ford driver.
With the emphasis there on badge, because, you know,
it's just
all NASCAR
right?
cars are identical anyway.
Right, it's just
yeah, and
shell.
I've heard they're a real damn handful to actually drive. You know, being rear-wheel drive and unlike anything that is actually a stock car. But that's a different story for a different time.
And they're the only remaining cars in America with carburetors.
Yes.
Oh, I have to tell you guys, this is totally not automotive-related, but I have actually got my first electric something besides my drill. I got a electric-powered...
do we really want to hear this?
Yes, I got an electric weed... That's funny. But I got an electric weed whip, and it also converts itself to an edger. I just went out and got it today. I saw it today, and I bought it today because I was so tired of my lousy...
I used to have one of those, Chris, and then I went and bought a gas one instead.
Well, they've gotten better, Sam. They really have, and this one's battery powered.
Well, they're fantastic when they're brand new, and the batteries have some oomph. But you're going to be whacking cordlessly for only a short time before
I don't have a lot of it, but it comes with two batteries, which was cool.
Yeah,
and
but you got to keep them all charged up. Don't ever let a battery sit halfway discharged. It'll die.
Yeah. Okay.
Don't let them get too hot.
Thanks for all your advice.
But I got lithium ion or nickel metal hydride.
It's lithium.
Oh, okay, then you might be okay.
Yeah, I think it's going to be just fine. And Dan, the usual negative Roth, I'm just going to ignore. So,
I'm sorry, man. I did landscaping.
Look,
and there's nothing better than a gas-powered string trimmer, man.
I've got to get around a swing set.
It doesn't have wheels. Let's move on.
It does have wheels, because when you edge it, it's got two wheels. But that's another story for another day. All right, for never again. All right, 2010 Corvette now has all manuals has launch control now. And first and foremost...
Will it void your warranty if you use it?
First of all, it does not void your warranty. Second of all...
No, because GM knows how to build a transmission that keeps its internals intact.
Right, it doesn't grenade. But second of all, the GM showed you how to use it, which was nice. But here's what you do. You go into competition mode. You put your foot on the clutch. You put it in first. You put your foot all the way to the floor on the gas pedal, and then you pop the clutch. It will get you to the optimal RPM range for that vehicle. Obviously, the ZR1, Z06, and Z51 Corvettes each have their own optimal rev range to start off, and it will put and it'll mitigate the wheel spin. Like, I think it's 100 or 1,000 times in a second, or 100 times a second. So
it uses the ABS.
So basically, you could be standing next to any fantastic track driver, and you could say 0 to 60 right now. You're going to be within a half of a tenth of a second. And they actually, the GM people actually threw some schmo in a Corvette versus their test car guy that gets all their numbers that they give, you know, their manufacturer numbers. He's their guy, right? And he did it the old-fashioned way. The nobody did it with traction control, and they were 0.05 seconds apart.
Yeah, so he bunged that 1-2 upshift. cost him 5/10, man. That's a half a second.
Yeah.
No, it's 5/100.
Oh, you're 0.05.
Yes.
Ah, okay.
I said 0.05.
Never mind.
I said 0.05.
No, I just didn't listen to you. Yeah,
was the pro driving with the launch controller? Or was
he had it off.
Manual?
He did it the okay. old-fashioned way, like I said. But then also the other.
So what does the pro get with launch control?
They didn't do that. But the other thing that was kind of cool was that they showed like a version. It was the Z06. The first one they showed was just some guy, you know. First he underdid it. You know, not enough gas off the line. Then he overdid it. Too much wheel spin. The under did it was a 4.2, and they're like, this was terrible, except you're going to beat almost everybody. And then the second one was 4.0, and they're like, that was way too much, and you're still going to beat almost everybody. And then the track I got a 3.6. And
that's a Z06?
That's a Z06, not the ZR1. He got a 3.6, and then the other guy, the nobody, got a 3.65. I mean, seriously, how do you argue that? I mean, that's not even the ZR1.
I'll tell you how you argue with that, because if you do that too much, you're still going to torch the clutch out of the thing. So,
well, if it doesn't avoid the warranty, have fun. You got a 100,000-mile powertrain warranty. You could do all the launches you want.
Yeah. Yeah, you can burn through a lot of U-joints and stuff.
Yeah, the Z06 was going at about 4,000 RPM, which is, I think, was about 500 RPM. Off of what the GTR does on its launch control, Sam.
Well, they've played with the GTR.
I'm not sure what number the GTR does.
The GTR used to be up at like $5,000, and I think they've lowered it and played around with it a bit. But either way, any car that has launch control or like the no lift shift that you get in the Cobalt SSs and stuff, all those things, they're inherently abusive to your powertrain, and they're cool to. At least, I guess, know that if you take your Corvette up to the drags or whatever, it'll help you launch.
For a while. Yeah, well, it's cool because you've got, I mean, you're going to do it probably 50 times during the time you own it, you know, if that, for most people. So, and people that are going to use it more than that, they're not even going to bother with launch control. They're going to do it the old-fashioned way, like, you know, that 0.05 you're going to get by doing it the good old-fashioned way if you really know what you're doing. All right, next up is the Aston Martin 177 won the Concorso di Eleganza Design Award, and it does look pretty cool. What do you guys think?
I think most of it looks great. I'm not crazy about the nose, but it's one of those things where, you know, a lot of the design of the nose was driven by functionality, you know, for getting air into the brakes and the engine and everything. So, yeah, I could live with it. You know, if somebody handed me the keys to a 177, I wouldn't turn it away.
And you'll probably get one before anybody else. And, you know, my personal opinion...
I have a sneaking suspicion they won't be doing any media drives with the 177.
Yeah, good call. I think the nose plays.
Since they're only building 77 of them.
The nose plays. So, that's my opinion. What do you think, Dan?
I dig it all the way around. I mean, it looks kind of... The nose is kind of weird with... The way it looks like a rodent that has stuffed his cheeks full of food, but you know what? It's quite aggressive, and it's some swagger from Aston Martin that we haven't seen with their very classically styled vehicle. You know, because you'd have trouble telling other Aston models apart from each other, unless you were a really hardcore fan, you know, unless you really looked at them. They all kind of looked very similar. So this one, you look at it instantly, you know what it is.
Now, what are they doing with the 177 to make it so special? I mean, it's going to cost a damn fortune, and they're only making 77 of them.
Well,
so,
they changed the nose and they cranked up the price. What else do you need?
No, it's a completely different car. I mean, the chassis, you know, it's got a carbon fiber chassis. You know, it's built like a McLaren F1, basically, but with the V12 engine in the front. They bumped it up to somewhere north of 600 horsepower. I can't remember exactly. They showed the rolling chassis for this car on the first day of the Geneva Motor Show, and I talked to the chief engineer on the project for a while about it. The stuff that's under the skin is just amazing on this car.
And let's not forget the interior is just drop dead gorgeous.
Oh yeah, that too. When I saw it, it didn't have an interior yet. It only had one racing seat installed in it. But the finished interior that they've put in this thing is just unreal.
So, yeah, there we go.
That's a lot. And a carbon fiber chassis is one hell of a place to start. That sounds expensive.
Yeah, and lots of machined aluminum. And, it looks... You know, like it's an engineer's dream. Let's just put it that way.
So you didn't get much sleep.
No.
Okay. Next up.
next. There's jokes in there somewhere, but let's just leave.
I was
alone.
Like, nobody's gonna say anything. That was a classic.
No,
all right.
No.
Taking a shot at Sam. Yep. All right. Next, we've got. You know, this it's kind of funny because in my opinion, this title's been mistitled. Cadillac the base new sub CTS on front wheel drive Epsilon 2 platform. And then when you read the post, it says basically, this is from Motor Trend, the STS / DTS replacement has been canned. Alpha has been canned. And the CTS is going to get larger. And basically, it's going to be STS style, which is only a couple inches bigger. And then the base model is going to be the Epsilon 2 platform, which
Cimarron.
Will be front / all-wheel drive, i.e. the LaCrosse that we're going to have next month. So basically, Cadillac's doing what a lot of other automakers are doing and having a front-wheel drive offering in the car and crossover ranks, just like Lincoln, just like Audi, just like Lexus, Acura. I mean, a lot of the...
Well, you know, they've already got the new SRX,
right?
You know, which who wrote this post here?
Noah
described as a super Theta, which it's not. It's actually more Epsilon 2 than Theta. So
right, but they did at the SRX primer, they did call it super Theta. So that's what Steve Shannon called it. So
All right. Well, at any rate, you know, there's a lot of Epsilon 2 in that vehicle as well. You know, so I think, you know, basically what you're potentially looking at is, like you say, you know, somewhere between the LaCrosse and the SRX. You know, you take the all-wheel drive from the Haldex all-wheel drive from the SRX, you know, put it on that LaCrosse platform, which, you know, you've already got that combination anyway on the Insignia in Europe for not the VXR, was it OTC, OPC? The one they just announced a week or two ago with the turbo V6, which is also available in the SRX and in the Saab 900 or the Saab 9.3 Turbo X. You know, so, you know, they're just cross-pollinating all kinds of hardware all over the place.
And that's what you should do. I mean, it's cost-effective that way. And if the LaCrosse starts at 27, then the Cadillac's probably going to start at 31. So, I mean, it's going to have the same powertrain more than likely, unless they, you know, come up with a diesel 2.9 to go in there, which I haven't heard anything about the 2.9 in the U.S. lately. And last year, it seems at this time, we were talking about it a lot.
There's like zero interest from GM for diesels in North America.
And I think most mainline auto manufacturers are in the same boat with diesel. They're not playing ball with diesel. I hear the sullen tone in your voice, Sam. But the thing that bums me out about this whole thing is Alpha was the platform that I was excited about from GM because it's the small rear-wheel drive, the 3 Series Fighter, the volume rear-drive luxury car that isn't going to happen now. So, I mean, I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, well, does this mean that Zeta is never going to Cadillac? And does this mean that, you know, if the CTS gets bigger, is that a good thing? I'm not necessarily certain that it is. I like the size of the CTS now. I never have liked the look of the STS.
Really? I think the STS is a little bit more restrained than the CTS. I mean, the CTS looks great, but the STS is... It's got this class about it that...
You know what? To me, it has, this dull to it. The Cadillac has a sharpness to it, or the CTS has a sharpness to it, and then they dulled it down a little bit with the STS, and I'm not buying that.
Well, and the STS came first.
Right. But that...
The first generation CTS came first.
The first CTS came first, and then the STS,
STS
and
was
then...
a stretched version of that.
Right, and now we've got... Well, it was... Yeah, and then it was also a further refinement of the original CTS look. Because I see that original CTS now, and I'm like, it's a little awkward. And then the new CTS, and it looks fantastic.
Well, the big thing that they did with the second generation CTS is they used the width of the STS on the CTS. Yeah. And that's why the original CTS looks awkward, is because it's narrow and tall. And the new one looks...
Well, it's also got more like Coke bottle in the doors and stuff. It's a very sharply styled car.
Right.
And
yeah.
The first one was a little bit slabby.
The new one looks low slung and ready to pounce, and the old one looked like it was like, hey.
Yeah, I think if you applied that look to, you know, if you took, you know, the current STS dimensions and just applied the updated look of the second gen CTS to that car, I think you could have a great-looking car, you know, for relatively little investment.
Yeah, I think it would look great because the STS isn't all that much bigger, and so I think to scale the CTS look to the STS size, it's not going to do it any damage. The proportions are about right in either one, so this is totally not a stylist talking, so...
You know what would be cool, and I just thought of this, and I don't know why, but... The LaCrosse has the 3-liter and 3.6, but the SRX has the 3-liter and the 2.8 turbo. Wouldn't it be a lot neater to have the Epsilon 2 sedan for Cadillac to have that 2.8 in it? I mean, it makes sense in a lot of ways.
Well, they've also got the 3-liter turbo that's in the Saab.
The 2.8 liter.
Well, yeah, they've got the turbo
X, 3-liter. The 2.8 turbo.
Oh, was it 2.8? I thought it was 3-liter. What the hell do I know?
Yeah,
I you know, I'm just an autoblog writer.
Don't say just. That's a lot, Dan. You had to bribe.
It's better than most.
You had to bribe two editors to get that job. So that's something.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I guess it could be cool, and especially if they get that 2.8 and they put direct injection in it and a little bit more power. I mean, the top end. You know,
that's a great engine. I mean, just in the Epsilon 1 and the Turbo X, that engine with the Haldex all-wheel drive, it's a very, very pleasing combination.
Okay. All right, I'm getting a little slappy.
What's that?
You said it's a very, very pleasing combination.
It's not what you said, Dan. It's the way you said it.
The way I said it.
You sounded extremely pleased. All right, let's get into the industry news at this point. We'll start with Chrysler. It looks like
Do we still have an industry?
It looks like it's a lot different.
For the moment.
It's a lot different, and it's going to be controlled by the UAW, so nothing's changed. All right, Chrysler lenders and the U.S. Treasury have agreed to terms. The UAW and Canadian auto workers have agreed to terms with Chrysler. It looks like the Fiat deal's going to get announced in the next day or so. So basically, they've got all their ducks in a row, and they're going to meet their May 1st deadline, from what I could tell.
So who would have thought a couple weeks ago that Chrysler actually looks like it's going to manage to pull it off versus GM?
Yeah, you know what though? I think one of two things is happening. Either they really want to go into bankruptcy at GM, and
I think they do.
They've got their ducks in a row, and the White House is behind them. Or two, they're using it as a huge bluff. And I think Chrysler's bluff was, hey, look, we're not even going to give you guys 60 days. We're only giving you 30 because you're not worth a damn. And I don't think you'll survive bankruptcy. That's the kind of things they said. That's what was said by the White House and that task force of schmucks. But So that these guys, they didn't even give it, they made it sound so dire in that announcement that I don't think anybody had any choice but to play ball. I mean, the $2 billion is better than nothing, which is what they would have got had Chrysler gone to bankruptcy.
Right. Yeah, let's detail it as the Chrysler's creditors, their major creditors, and let's be specific here. Chrysler's mostly propped up by secured debt, if I'm remembering correctly. So that means that at any point, Chrysler's creditors can call in their debts.
Yeah, but I mean, it's basically, if I said, Dan, you owe me $50,000 and I want it today and you don't have $50, what am I going to do? That's basically what you get.
Right,
that's
exactly.
That's why they're at that point. And
they've agreed to take $2 billion now,
right,
and forgive the rest, and there's other parts of the deal. So you know, it sounds like they've managed to get concessions all around from the UAW, the CAW, and Fiat seems like they're on board,
right.
So.
And the one thing I wanted to mention, and I don't want to dwell on this for very long, is that among the points was 55% stake in the company for the UAW, and they're going to have a spot on the board. Now, the 55% I can care less about, although I think it's pretty ironic that a lot of people blame the unions for what's going on here, at least partially, and then in the end they end up with the company. But the bigger thing I have a problem with is the board representation. If it's a small minority representation on the board, then I say that they deserve it. If it's a big representation, even coming close to a majority, then I have a horrible problem with it, because there's no way Chrysler can be competitive with labor running the show. Because, for example, if they wanted to build a truck in Mexico and you're on the board and you're from the UAW, what do you say? No. I mean, the no is the only answer, right? And then even if it saves $1 billion.
Not necessarily.
It depends. I mean, if your UAW plants are kicking out all that they can and your truck volume
okay,
needs to be
okay,
filled.
Let me reiterate. There's one plant that's got to go, and there's one in Mexico, and there's one in Detroit. What are they going to do? They're going to close the Mexico plant.
You have an episode of Auto Warriors.
I wish we could get a sponsorship like that. Man, that looked beautiful. I was watching that at work, getting very jealous. It was a spoof, and they spent lots of money. Anyway,
oh, that was great stuff, man.
It was beautifully done.
For those that have no idea what we're talking about, go check out Onion Network News. And look for Auto Warriors.
Right. Well, I'm doing the post tonight, so you'll be able to see it by the time the podcast comes out. So
I was just astounded by the production values there.
That's
they spent
what I
more
thought.
Money on that one.
Yeah.
They spent more money on that one video than we spent all year on video.
And they put those out every day.
Yeah,
it was awesome.
Must be nice to have financial backing.
I want to know how they where they found.
Hey, Cheetos, you know we're much less expensive than Onion Network News. So
here's what I'm thinking: how in the world did they get those two middle-aged white people to be so serious and good at what they were doing? They were awesome.
Oh, those fantastic actors.
They're
paid
professionals.
Them.
They were really good. I mean, they were.
Oh,
but anyway.
What? Oh yeah, we were talking about the UAW on the Chrysler board.
Yeah. I mean, maybe so, or maybe the unions aren't really the reason why Chrysler is floundering right now anyway. I blame the Germans.
Yeah, the Germans are. The Germans are the main.
They're out of it now. And so
they just had to give back their 20% and pay a whole bunch of money.
There was the part that they kept saying, they got to contribute $600 million towards the pensions. That's true, and that's $200 million a year through 2011. But the other part was Daimler was owed $1.5 billion, and they're not getting it. So
good.
Yeah, they're not. So basically,
they
it's $2.1 billion
company.
that they're losing to get rid of 20%.
You know, they came in and they raided the kitty. They should give back all the $15 billion they stole from Chrysler. They came in and they had this mass exodus of all the talent that made Chrysler what it was through the 90s, and their products now are just.
A shell
such
of what
a
they want
shadow
for.
Yeah, a shadow of their former selves.
Here's a little,
it's all down to Daimler.
Here's a little irony for you. Volkswagen and Audi have gotten together so incredibly well because, you know, the tail wasn't wagging the dog. It was the mainline manufacturing owning the smaller luxury arm, and so they shared a lot. They collaborated. They did what they could to make both products extremely successful. And last year, Audi outsold Mercedes in Europe, okay? This is huge. So Audi is...
Yeah, but Chris, there's a huge difference there. Volkswagen and Audi are both two German companies. They both have...
Right, I understand all that, Sam, but I'm saying that they did it the right way. The fact that they're German is immaterial for what I'm saying.
No. I don't think that's immaterial. I think the biggest reason why Chrysler got so screwed up was Daimler's culture was ported over here on top of Chrysler's culture, and the two just never kind of managed to find a symbiotic relationship. So Daimler came in and they looked at what Chrysler was working on, and they were like, "This will not do.
Right.
We cannot do it this way. Every nut bolt I want to see now."
Right. Well, that was part of it, but I think the bigger part of it was the collaboration between Audi and Volkswagen is why that partnership works. And they didn't.
The collaboration between Audi and Volkswagen has to happen, though, because neither would have any product without sharing all those platforms.
That's exactly what happened with Daimler and Chrysler. They didn't share. Chrysler pruned up, and then we have the shell of a company that we used to know and love. That was my whole point. Daimler was not interested in giving any componentry to Chrysler unless it was old, outdated. A couple platforms that they gave them the old.
They didn't even give them platforms. What Daimler wanted to do and what they ended up doing was forcing a Mitsubishi platform on Chrysler's midsize cars, and it's not a bad platform in and of itself. It's just that the cars are already designed. And Daimler was like, no, you'll do it again.
Right.
And you'll do it in record time.
Right.
And, you know, the other thing, too, is Daimler saw Chrysler, you know, as a threat, you know, to its image. Whereas, you know, at VW and Audi and all the other brands that are part of the VW group, they see all those brands as complementing each other. Yeah, they share technology under the skin, but they see it, you know, kind of like the old GM where you had this stepping stone, you know, through the brands. You know, in the old days, you know, you'd go through GM and Pontiac and Oldsmobile and Buick up to Cadillac, you know, and VW, you know, you've got Seat and Skoda at the bottom and then Volkswagen and Audi and on up to Bentley and
Lamborghini.
You know, so, you know, they see all those brands as complementing each other rather than as a threat. You know, the Daimler people saw, you know, Chrysler's, you know, the association with Chrysler, you know, is dragging down their reputation instead of, you know, saying, you know, okay, here's a stepping stone. You know, you start off with a Chrysler or Dodge vehicle, and as you get more affluent, you know, you can move up to a Mercedes.
Right.
What Daimler saw, all that Daimler saw was a pile of cash. Because at that point had, what did they have? They needed to redo the E-Class, and they had no money to do so. So they were like, oh, we'll just buy Chrysler and take their money.
Right. Well, I think in the big picture...
We can blame Jürgen Schramm for everything.
I think the last couple years where they've been losing money hand over fist has kind of been their just desserts for what they did. So now they're free and clear, and they've got to be absolutely thrilled with the fact that, I mean, they've already written Chrysler off a year ago, but they've got to be pretty thrilled. All right, so basically Chrysler's still going to be around, but GM, in some form or another. And GM...
Here's my thought about GM, just to put it out there right now.
Go ahead and jump the gun, Dan.
I guess the biggest news, one of the biggest items in news is that they're reportedly going to close Pontiac up by 2010.
Not reportedly. They are going to close Pontiac up.
Yeah, that's really fast to even do an orderly kind of shuttering, which makes me think that they really do want to go into bankruptcy. And Fritz keeps going, oh, it's very likely. And I think that they want to go into bankruptcy so that they can then kind of wipe aside their dealer agreements, because that's what got them when they closed Oldsmobile. It was a cost from something like $1 billion. To close that brand up, then they had to pay all the franchisees everything.
Part of the problem there, you know, I was on a conference call yesterday with Ray Young, the CFO from GM, and you know, part of the problem with the whole Oldsmobile deal when they decided to shut it down, you know, they gave them like 3-4 years notice and said, okay, you know, you guys have 3 more years, we're going to keep stocking you with cars for that time, you know, but because they announced that Oldsmobile was going to go away, you know, they ended up with all these cars that nobody wanted to buy. Mm-hmm. And so that's what they ended up having to pay for, was all that inventory, to liquidate all that inventory. This time around, you know, the thing that Young said yesterday was that, you know, they learned from those mistakes and they're going to stop building those cars basically right now.
Yeah, well, they have to. I mean, they have to be already working on closing it.
Right, but they're still going to...
For Saturn and Hummer, you know, the end of the 2009 model year, which for this year effectively is June, that's it. They're not building any more Saturns or Hummers after June. And then, you know, Pontiac, you know, they'll probably build them for a few more months, and that's it. You know, and then whatever's, you know, they've got till the end of next year to unload those cars, and that's it. And they're not, GM is not planning on paying out a dime to dealers because, well, frankly, they don't have any money to pay out the dealers to close down those dealerships.
Right.
So they're just going to say, you, and you, you're done. You know, and you're the low-selling, low-volume dealers. You know, we can't afford to support you anymore, so that's it. You're finished.
How are they going to manage that without bankruptcy?
Here are some of the numbers that GM's working with the dealers. They currently have 6,246 dealers, which is about three times as many as Toyota has in the United States. They're going to cut it down to 3,605, which is a reduction of 2,600. Now, this morning in the paper, in the Detroit papers, they were saying that about 1,200 of the low-performing slash Hummer slash Saturn dealers are going to account for those 1,200 that they're going to do in the next year. Okay, so those are going to be in the short term. They will be buying some inventory from them, but I'm guessing, like Sam said, it's not going to be very much because they are not overly stocked right now beyond the 100 days that they've got, and they're not building anymore. So there's going to be some short term cash there, but that's a lot of dealers going away, and the NADA, National Automotive Dealers Association, said that was about 130,000 jobs from those 1,200 dealerships alone. So that's just kind of showing the human toll of what's happening here. But the fact is,
and those are jobs. I mean, those are GM techs. Those are salespeople. I mean, they're not in a market like this. They're not going to necessarily be able to go and just find employment at another GM dealership,
right? Well,
dealership.
The thing is the aftermarket is still scratching and clawing for automotive techs, and the transplant automakers have never really had adequate supplies of technicians. So everybody's always looking for technicians. That's the last guy you need to worry about. The salespeople, the car porters, all those guys are going to have a hell of a time getting a job, which is about two-thirds of that number. So technicians, I'm not worried about. Everybody else, they're going to have a real tough time getting jobs in this market. But, I mean, because the new model is, I mean, the Toyota slash Honda model is, you know, very few stores, but all of them are extremely successful. And that's, and it costs them less money to deliver the vehicles to them, and that's what GM wants. They don't want to spend all this money on the dealerships for marketing, for delivery. I mean, having 6,246 dealers to deliver cars to, oh my God. I mean, that's a lot of cars.
Not to mention, you know, they cannibalize each other's sales when you have so many dealers, you know, in a metropolitan area, you know, selling the same brand. You know, they're fighting each other for sales.
And you're paying for marketing for both.
Driving down their transaction prices.
Right, and you're paying for marketing for both. I mean, you're saying, okay, here's your $5,000 allotment, and here's your $5,000 allotment. You guys go kill each other. It's like celebrity death match with dealers.
It's stupid the way the system works right now.
Right.
Well, and it's not the first time GM has closed up brands. So, you know, we've lost Oldsmobile. We further back, you know, there was Oakland going way back.
Well, Oakland turned into Pontiac.
Oakland. Yeah, I guess they became Pontiac.
But, yeah, there was.
What was the Buick? There was another. There was a Buick line, like the inexpensive Buick. I forget. And there was like LaSalle.
LaSalle
became Cadillac.
Yeah, LaSalle was part of GM. There was a bunch of brands that have gone away over the years. So it's not a new thing for brands to go away. And, you know, other brands will pop up to take their place.
Right. In the last 25 years, we've lost AMC, we've lost Oldsmobile, we've lost Eagle. So,
well, I don't know Eagle that I necessarily AMC. Want to use the word lost.
You know? We had an Eagle Vision, and it made 62,000 miles before it took a crap. That was a great car. 62.
But one of the interesting things about GM's announcements yesterday was that, you know, they they revised all their projections, you know, in their viability plan. Instead of, you know, when they first had their viability plan in, back in December or January, you know, they made their projections based on the assumption that, you know, there would be a 12 to 13 million annual sales volume for the U.S. market.
Long term.
Which, well, even like, you know, even in the near term, you know, not necessarily this year, but, you know, in the next 2 to 3 years.
And, I wouldn't bet on it.
Well, but that's what their projections were based on. Yeah.
Yeah.
And clearly, you know, over the first 4 months of this year, you know, that's not the case. And so all their new projections are based on, you know, how they can make money in a 10 million unit sales market, which is, you know, closer to where we are this year. And so if they think they can make money, you know, if they've got a plan where they can make money in a 10 million unit market, then they're in good shape.
Right. And then, yeah, because then if you hit 12 million, you're talking gravy there, and you've got your optimized plants all around the country and all around North America. So
yeah. And, you know, they've been eclipsed by Toyota as the largest automaker.
Volkswagen, in this first quarter.
So why fight it? Why try to be the largest? Why don't you just try to maximize your profit, so you make the least amount of cars for the most amount of money?
That's exactly what they're trying to do now.
That's it. And you've got four brands, and you could build on
with
those,
the exception of the Volt.
Yeah, you could build on those four brands, but I think the Volt is like, it's like spending money on marketing. It's just it's automotive marketing. It's actually it's a tangible product that they're marketing. So it's, I mean, even then, I mean, image wise, the Volt is going to help GM. So if it helps GM and if it helps proliferate the Volt platform, then it's going to do its job. And I, you know, everybody knows it's going to lose money, but I mean, is it really losing money when you're gaining so much in terms of goodwill and, you know, getting
and that's what they need.
Getting California off your back. I mean,
no, they're never going to get California off the back.
On you, get over here.
And you know, we're going to have Massachusetts Stan following suit. So yeah, the next thing they're going after is carbon dioxide emissions. And then after that, it's going to be, oh, these batteries that we mandated, they're toxic. What a thunk. Idiots.
California. All right, so I think the GM situation we're going to cover a lot more closer to the May 31st deadline. But one interesting thing that I found interesting anyways, Troy Clark was on WWJ here in Detroit, and he's the president of GM North America, and he was saying that he thinks that the industry has bottomed out and that he expects a uptick in sales in the next month. So,
you know what? Even if it hasn't, let's just start saying it has, because that's the power of the media, you see, and all these idiot news readers, they say, oh, well, that's terrible.
Well, I think
it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So let's turn it around and say it's getting better. Everybody go out and buy a car.
Well, I think to some extent, the media expedited the downfall of the industry to begin with their negative
advertising. Of course they did.
Because basically, they know they sell more newspapers and, you know, better ads and all that stuff if they start talking doom and gloom. A classic example. And it's Autoblog readers, and we did a top 10 greatest Pontiacs of all time. These are the cream of the crop, the best, some of the best muscle cars and pony cars that the world has ever seen. And the Pontiac brand at one point was fabulous, and in some cases now today, like the G8, very good car, and then with the Solstice, very solid vehicle, and very few 2C convertibles out there, and none from the, you know, American automakers except for the Solstice. So, and to a lesser extent, the Sky. But, I mean, we did two posts, the 10 greatest and the 10 worst. Which one do you think got more traffic? 10 worst, because it's negative, and people think, we can laugh along at it. And, it was the same post we did twice, but the one got the better traffic,
the contrast is, though? Look at the cars, look at the era of cars that made Pontiac, that at least recently made Pontiac what it is. It's DeLorean, man. It's the Tempest, the GTO, the Judge, the Firebird, all that stuff that happened in the late 50s and early 60s when John DeLorean was running the brand. And then you get some knuckleheads in there that go, okay, well, we need the B-body. Let's get the Safari Wagon. That sounds like a good idea. And how about we get a a minivan because everybody else has a minivan. So they sort of lost their way and they just started becoming a full line manufacturer. That's what happened to GM. All of their brands became full line brands and they started just offering identical things with different.
Right. When it starts coming back to those 6,200 dealers and then the 500,000 union heads that they had to feed every month. And, you know, they had to keep all the factories rolling. So they said, well, you know, we've got two minivan factories. How can we possibly make 480,000 minivans go away every month? Because we have to, because we will pay through the nose for the rest of eternity if we don't build this many. So they're damned that they do, and if they're damned that they don't, so they spent as little money as possible badge engineering each one of these vehicles to look slightly different. And then they sold them all through those massive channels of crap that they call their dealer body, because back then it was like 9,000, right? Even 12 years ago.
And GM, I mean, GM back in this era, the times that we kind of picked to represent the best, they were overall as an organization among all their brands, they were innovators. You know, you get the Tempest, the A-body. The A-body was based, you know, the Corvair was an A-body. The Corvair was like rear engine air-cooled, flat six, a very innovative vehicle. And then you get the Tempest, which has a cable drive shaft for a flat floor and a rear-mounted transaxle in 1961 with an independent rear suspension, fully independent rear suspension. I mean, what the hell?
All right, that's pretty that's, awesome stuff. But
you know, they had the overhead cam 6.
And then the 80s cars. Pontiacs were a series of really bad...
Well, I mean, they were good ideas brought down by crappy execution. The X cars, not that Pontiac really was ever a large player with the X cars, but they were better until they went into production. And and the Fiero was a great idea. That just was totally screwed up by first 4 years of it, or first 3 years.
Well, the Fiero was broken by internal GM corporate politics because Chevrolet didn't want the Corvette to be threatened by a Pontiac.
But it's such a different car. I wish they had not been so stupid. You know, the Fiero is such a different thing than the Corvette, and they could have coexisted.
You know, it shouldn't matter, I think they should have been able to compete with one another. You can't say, you know what, if they're that, make the Corvette better. That's an easy solution, isn't it? I mean, just improve the Corvette and don't worry about, you know, keep your eye on the ball.
Well, I mean, GM was on the ropes in the 80s, too, so it was all they could do to just kind of manage to build the GM10 platform and make sucky Luminas for the entire, you know, decade. So are we going to go through the cars, or what's the...
No, you know, I
got us off track.
On second thought, I think we're probably running a little bit behind. I think it looks like everybody from Autoblog actually read it already, so I think we're pretty much good. The list wasn't all that interesting, so... and I did one of them, so... All right, we've got quite a few questions I want to get through on the podcast from last week. First one, okay, this guy's looking for an affordable hatchback. He wants practicality and fuel economy. That's a big surprise. And he reads Autoblog daily and listens to the podcast as soon as it's downloaded, so thank you very much, and your name is... Shane. All right, Shane. God, talk to your dad and mom about that. All right,
Don't insult the guy's name. Come on. I mean, Nick was very upset last week when we insulted his
spelling and his grammar. Spelling.
Yeah, I want to know how that prom worked.
Yeah, I want to see what he did. All right, so he's looking at the 2009 Honda Fit, a vehicle I know Sam likes because, for one, his daughter drives it. He thinks $17,000 is pricey. So,
I mean, you don't have to buy a Fit for $17,000. You can buy a Fit for
14,
you know, for 13 and a half, 14,000. Yeah. And the other option too is you don't necessarily have to buy a 2009 Fit. No reason you couldn't buy a 2007. You know, use 2007. You know, and save a few grand that way. So, you know, that's certainly a very viable option.
Well, and he goes on to say that he also thinks the Versa has a lot of strengths and can be found used for around $10,000. So,
So used Fit's probably not a horrible idea. My personal favorite always will be is the Mazda 3 hatchback. You can get, it ranges wildly in price.
I think if you're looking for fuel economy, though, the Fit and the Versa are going to kill.
Not with the 2 liter. I mean, the Fit on the Fit on the highway gets 34, and the Mazda 3 gets a 33. So it's close. It's darn close.
I think the fit is probably closer to actual numbers than...
Well, than how do you know? The, I mean, but if you're good within two miles per gallon...
I haven't seen that C1 platform deliver that kind of mileage. That's all I'm saying. I mean, I'm skeptical that you'll get that in everyday driving. I'm more optimistic that the fit will actually return what it says
and
it will.
And you've noticed that the fit does that well when you drive it?
I've driven neither.
I got 33 with an 09 fit when I had one for review last fall. So if I can get 33 out of it,
yeah. But you were driving with an egg under the pedal, weren't you?
Me?
Yeah, he was drafting. Mr. Well, you know,
the guy who's never gotten more than 17 miles per gallon with any Lambda, no matter how much people scream that they can get 21 and 22.
Lambda cannot get 22 miles to the gallon unless you're.
Yeah, listen, you can't. But here, we drove. What was we had the?
I don't believe
Sam and
it.
I drove the ZR1. Would you get 11?
Well, the guy's not asking for. I mean, that's kind of a hatchback, but obviously it's not going to be $17,000, and the guy's not asking about that. So,
all right.
You know, part of the problem is, you know, until relatively recently, hatchbacks in general have been somewhat short supply in the U.S. market because. You know, like station wagons, Americans decided that they didn't like hatchbacks. And so, you know, aside from the Fit, the Versa, you know, there weren't a whole lot of options. Yeah, well,
you could. I don't know if the Astra's going to return that kind of mileage either. Yeah, I would actually be rather pessimistic.
Okay, nuts and bolts. $13,000 we'll use as an average number. What are you going to pick, Sam?
I would go with either a base Fit or, you know, look at, you know, maybe a two-year-old Fit.
Okay, and... Dan, what would you pick?
I would have to say that the Fit's a good option, although there's the Yaris that does get decent mileage.
This guy might be single. I don't think he's going to want to do a Yaris.
No, yeah, nobody in their right mind should really want to do a Yaris. the hatch is just dismal.
Oh, he's down on the seriously. Versa looks. He said it was pug fugly. So if he's
yeah, but
he's
not that's gonna, that, I don't think so, that, so man. I think the Versa actually looks halfway okay.
Yes, me too. But I'm saying my point is, if he thinks that's kind of ugly, you know, look at the Yaris. But okay, go ahead.
And I actually think the Versa has a nicer interior than the Fit. Although the 09 Fit may have a better interior now, but Nissan had some of the better interiors in that. The Sentra and Versa actually felt pretty nice from the inside. Yeah, I mean, the Fit's a really good choice. If he says he loves the GTI, well, how about a Golf? You don't have to get a GTI, and you don't have to get it brand new.
You're not going to have to get it really used, and we've talked about VW.
Well, no, I mean, you don't. Their maintenance and reliability may not be tops, but you do also hear a lot of people that are very pleased with their Volkswagen.
Of course they do. They're like the people who buy Macs. You can't buy a Volkswagen and say it sucks.
Well, I mean, that's the people that buy Toyotas and Hondas, too. There's like this cult of you can't ever say anything bad about the car. You know, oh, it's only needed oil changes and a transmission. You know, so
but,
it's
I mean,
like,
something's going to happen, right?
Whatever.
No.
Well, I mean, any car is going to have problems. So you could get, you know, look, you could buy a Fit for $9,000 that's been in a flood. And it's going to be problematic. So, you know, shop carefully and see what you can find. The Fit is probably going to be very pleasing to drive versus the Versa that's not quite as sporty. So, and, you know, again, like there's the Astra and the Yaris that you should at least look at just so you can laugh at them. I'm trying to think of anything else that
you can just pick one. I just asked you to pick one because if you pick three, you're going to put us all to sleep. All right.
All right, find the Fit. All right, whatever.
I'm going to go with the Mazda 3, and I just looked it up on AOL Autos, and the Fit was within is 2 miles per gallon better in the city. I'm sorry, than the Mazda 3, and they were the same on the highway. So. For my money, it's the Mazda 3. Looks better, drives probably better. I haven't driven a Fit, so
I don't think it drives any better.
It drives well enough, and it looks good.
They're probably drives well.
And it looks good, and I think it's got a little bit more room too. So for me, I'm going to get the Mazda 3.
Yeah, it's the Mazda doesn't.
The Fit is definitely roomier.
The Fit has packaging efficiency.
It looks tall. It doesn't look wide.
That's why it's got packaging efficiency.
Yeah.
You can very comfortably seat four adults in a Fit.
Yeah. And one, right. The 3 is a lot heavier than a Fit, too, which is going to kill your fuel mileage a lot more than you think.
Okay. I don't know that it's heavier or not.
Next
question is, guys, he's been listening for a very short time, but he thanks us for our fantasticness.
Well, it's about time.
That's because he's been listening for a short time. He won't thank us.
He just had a baby. James, congratulations. I didn't know guys can do that. And he has to get rid of...
You don't watch
it's
Oprah, man.
Yeah, I'm pregnant. All right, so he thinks it's time for the G35 to go, and I don't think it is, but if you think so, that's fine.
Yeah, G35 coupe is going to be a real pain in the ass with a child.
One of my friends it's a she, and she's
any
got...
Any coupe is a pain with a child.
She's got...
Been there, done that.
It's, I don't think it's totally bad, but... All right, he doesn't want a large SUV or a minivan, and you don't need one with one kid, man. You've got one kid. Even if you've got two, you don't need it. All right, maybe a compact SUV, i.e. a crossover. But his first choice, and you're going to love this, is Sport Wagon.
He wants
a Sport Wagon of some sort. A Sporty Wagon, not the Sport Wagon. So,
Sporty
he's got
wagon.
One kid?
He likes the Sport 9.3 Combi, so he's obviously easy to please. He thinks it's too expensive, though.
No. It's sticker price is too high. Nobody buys a Saab.
You can buy a Saab
retail
for about $20.
you can buy the whole brand for a couple hundred. I mean, really, it's
You could probably buy the brand for less than a new Honda Fit right now.
Yeah, I mean, I just one of the listservs I'm on. A guy just bought a brand new Saab Combi for stupid short money.
How stupid
and
was it, Dan?
They're
can
wonderful
you give us a
cars.
Because James is going to go to his Canadian dealer and say, I believe I can get this for stupid money, or
stupid that he bought a Saab.
I don't recall off the top of my head, but I think it was something like 26.
That's pretty cheap. All right,
which is pretty cheap for a Saab, and they're pretty nice cars.
He thought WRX 265 five door. He said that might be a little too boy racer for him.
That car's for
kids.
Yeah, and the back seat's going to be kind of cramped when you throw a car seat in there.
Cheap inside.
Yeah, and he would like to have all-wheel drive if possible because he lives in Canada on top of a snowy hill. So the G35, he buy a set of snow tires. He got the G35 first, and then he moved up on top of the hill. So okay,
full set
wagons.
Of snows, dude.
Let's go wagons. Front-wheel drive, all-wheel drive. I think probably front-wheel drive would probably work as well.
A4 Avant.
But I think he's probably not looking to spend over $30,000.
Did he say anything about a budget?
Yeah, the Sport Combi was too pricey for him, and then the WRX 26. So
yeah,
I'm saying
the A4 25 will be to 30, definitely too
25
pricey.
To 30,000, I think, is a decent...
Okay, you know what he wants? He wants a Volvo V70.
A Jetta Sport Wagon.
Yeah, the Jetta Sport Wagon is a good choice. The Volvo V70, you can actually... And if you don't want the butch, like... cross country stuff, I think you can still get a V70 with all wheel drive. They're a very good used car deal. I don't know about the newer ones that are more closely aligned with the S80, but the slightly older ones, the P2 platform, V70s and S60s are ridiculously good used car bargains. And that's a very nice wagon. I mean, what's wrong with a legacy wagon?
Yeah, I would recommend the legacy wagon over the WRX. You still get the all-wheel drive. I think you can get the turbo boxer in there, right? In the legacy wagon, or is it only the Outback?
Wouldn't that be like a legacy, like a 2.5 GT or something?
Yeah,
I forget what they call it.
All right. But, I mean, yeah, it's still, even without the turbo, you know, it's still a reasonably decent performer.
Or a Forester.
You know, I like the Outback.
I like the Outback a lot more than the
Forester.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a better looking
one of my neighbors just got one, and it looks so sharp. It's that brownish gray
like
color. It looks great, man.
I like just the regular Legacy. The Outback is so stupid looking.
The other thing to consider too is maybe, you know, a couple year old A4 Avant.
Yeah, you know, yeah, well, that would be my suggestion is that, you know, I don't think you're going to find a vehicle that drives much better than an A4 Avant and can handle pretty much anything you can throw at it. I was so impressed with the A5 that I drove this winter. It had all season tires on it, and it just plowed through a nasty snowstorm like nobody's business. I was very impressed, and it's very similar to the A4 Avant, so.
Yeah, if you get the A4 Avant with the 2-liter turbo and quattro, you're good to go pretty much anywhere.
Yeah. And the interiors are the best in the business, really, at least for that price range. And yeah, you know, and it is a VW product, so there may be some of that maintenance stuff, but anything with all-wheel drive is not going to be immune. So, you know, you're going to end up paying some money for that hardware if that's what you want.
I just decided to go on eBay Motors and 2006 A4 Avant 2.0 Quattro. Buy it now. Price is $19,000 with 42,000 miles on it. So you could probably get it for about $17,000-$18,000. And that, you know what? I just clicked on it. It's a great looking car. I mean, it is really sharp. And it's also in Connecticut, so you could probably drive down and get it, Dan. So it's in Madison, Connecticut.
Now, Madison's a little far from me.
Straight up trade for the S60?
I'm not doing another European vehicle. As much as I like the Audis, we're going to be going very blue-collar American next time.
Wow. That was really touching. Yeah, there's two different ones. So there's this one's got nav.
I'm tired of the European cars costing me so much money every time.
Oh, I hear you. You could also get you can get an 07 if you want it a little bit newer. 07 with only 18,000 miles for $24,000. So it's still,
yeah. See, that's a much better deal.
It's still. And I mean, it's got a lot less miles, and it's got the navigation. So
I don't know what are the go on AOL Autos and look up a V70, like a 2007 V70.
I don't want to.
I bet you they're gonna go for like 17.
Okay, let's see, Volvo V70 or.
Yep. No.
What about the V50?
The V50.
But he was looking at a WRX, and the A4 Avant's not that much bigger. I'm just saying, man, they're very close in size.
The A4 is definitely roomier than the WRX.
Well, definitely. But the A4 and the V50 are very close. They're within 3-4 inches of each other.
Yeah, but the V50 and the V70.
Okay, check this out.
And I think that with a kid with a stroller, trust me, you're gonna want that slight extra bit of it. Because the V50 is not gonna get any better mileage.
Well, Chris, you've got an S40. You know, the V50 is just the wagon version of that car. Yeah. Do you find it easy to put, did you ever?
Well,
put,
your kids are older.
I drive the lunch all the time, and we have four adults in the car all the time. And the guy that we go with is bigger than me. So we've got two girls in the back, two very big guys in the front, and we all fit. So.
Okay. Well, let's just say, you know, that's another one for him to look at.
Okay. And then there's, the V70 that you asked about 22,000 for basically the same 2007 22? Model with 18,000 miles on it. So it's $3,000 cheaper and it's much larger. On the downside, it doesn't get nearly as good fuel economy as the A4, but
if you're gonna spend that kind of money, you might as well just go with the Audi because it's so much better driving car. It's a better all-around car. And I say this as a Volvo owner. I would just buy an Audi.
There you have it. All right, so I'm gonna pull off one more question before we call it a night. We got plenty of...
We just got a new one.
Okay.
This Hyundai question? Yeah, I don't know if... I'm not prepared to answer that one.
No. All right.
I just wanted to say the person who had the one European, one Japanese, and one American with luxury sport and whatever SUV truck thing, that was the best question we've had in a long time, and it was so good that the people that responded on to the podcast in the comment section actually commented on it with theirs, and we didn't even ask them to, so you know that it was a good question. So,
yeah, and they responded.
Yeah,
better
you know
than
what? No, I liked mine. I didn't like yours, but I liked mine. All right.
I didn't like mine either.
Please tell Dan that keeping my Dodge is not an option. If I spend more money on it, I am going to choke. Since I got it, I have literally paid for it twice with other repairs, and things keep breaking. So obviously he knows you well enough to know what you're going to say. Okay, he's talking about family haulers. He is a family of five like mine. Two car seats and impossible to fit all five into his falling apart 04 Intrepid. He likes the Mazda 5, which I do as well, and it's the top of his list. So he wants to spend $20,000 or less, okay? He needs to have a folding third row, and he wants something that's small and compact, so that's going to be tough. And then he wants good fuel economy. Basically, this guy wants the sun, the stars, and the moon. And no SUVs, but it's going to be $20,000, so obviously,
okay.
You know, he's not going to get that anyway.
Let's
see. I would cut the list off after the Mazda 5.
Mazda 5 is an excellent choice. What about... Hyundai's got to have an option the in the 20,000 with the third row.
They've got the Kia Rondo. The Rondo has
so much
third
rather
row.
Have the Mazda 5 than the...
Oh, I would absolutely as well. I mean, the Rondo is kind of gummy feeling after the Mazda. You know, it's not bad.
As much as people like to denigrate minivans in this country for some silly reason, the reality is if you're putting kids in and out of the car... Having those sliding doors.
Great.
It's the Mazda 5. It does it anyway, so you've got to...
No, and you know, I just drove a Mazda 5 not too long ago. I only had it for like a couple of days in between something better. and I mean, it was like loaded. It had the full boat. It had nav, leather. It was very, very nice. And wasn't that expensive. And I was just impressed as hell with it. It didn't drive like any kind of a van. It was roomy, comfortable. Very pleasant.
I want one.
I really, really liked it. Yeah. It, because I endorse it.
Yeah, that's exactly. You just sold me so big.
Yeah.
Well, who wouldn't want anything that Dan endorses?
I'm telling you, we just sponsor.
Well, I still haven't endorsed the Socialist Party, so there you go.
Yeah. Well, you don't live in
Massachusetts. Basically...
Yeah, I wouldn't suggest keeping his Dodge. I mean, if an Intrepid with five people, you have two car seats.
I know what Marcus was thinking. He could hear you saying the following: "Look, just fix the car you already have. It fits. You're going to save yourself some money." So he wanted to make sure you know that it wasn't an option. He knows you. He knows you well enough to bring that up. So okay, Marcus also had a second question. Basically, he said if he spends under $20,000 on a primary car, he has about $10,000 left for something fun on the weekends, but he's 6'2", and it can't be a Miata. $10,000.
But see, okay, wait. If you buy the 5, well, I guess you can't really take the 5 weekend autocrossing, but it's actually pleasing to drive.
So,
I like
for
the
10 for $10,000, he can get quite
actually kind of fun.
Who says you can't take a 5? Who says you can't take a 5?
Well, you can. I mean, basically, if you spend $20,000 on a Mazda 5, you've got $5,000 for lots and lots of tires that you're going to chew up autocrossing.
Yeah, well, and you know, do a little suspension work on there. Good to go.
Yeah. But anyway, he doesn't want a Miata. He doesn't want...
Miata, and he wants something that his head's going to fit in. So $10,000, can you guys come up with anything really good? I'm spent. I can't think of anything. Sam, I'm counting on you. You're the brains of this organization.
I don't know, maybe a used Mustang?
I was just going to say Mustang. SN95, like the last couple of years of it, you can get something bitching. Maybe not that great, though.
Yeah, it's probably going to get the crap beat out of it, but that's fine.
They tend to plow. S2000? Not for $10,000. Let's see. What else did
you
I
know,
really
our boy
like?
Harley bought a... I believe it was a Boxster for $15,000. So you could get pretty much anything for $10,000 if you really think about it. You can get a used BMW 3 Series with 100,000 miles on it. I mean, if you just...
if you want to dump another $10,000,
right? I mean,
you can get a decent E36 for 5 to 10. You can get it, and that's, I mean, you can even get one that's been modified and modified well
for
if
the
you
better,
shop
right?
carefully. So, yeah,
of course, you're gonna spend a lot more than that, you know, in repairs and parts afterwards. But
well, the E36 is actually not that bad. To keep up. There's, you know, like all vehicles, there's some expensive pieces, but overall, it's not like the more modern BMWs that are just full of ridiculousness.
Okay, here's a question. What about like an older WRX or an older...
Speaking of something that's going to cost a lot of money.
Right, I mean, they're...
You beat on those all-wheel drive systems and even just running them. I mean, they don't last forever. And they have, you know, what, 8 CV joints, or is it 10 in the whole setup? And you know, you start putting a lot of power down.
It's probably
8,
I think.
Yeah. They get expensive. They could be fun. It could be fun, and you could definitely get it for that kind of money.
All right, I just read the new question that we got, and I want to get to it. So, Marcus,
no, let's
you want to save it for next week?
Week?
Okay. All right, we're already an hour and 20 minutes in, so we're probably...
Yeah, it's 11:36. I got to go watch Nightline.
God, man. You are so much fun. All right.
Not so much.
I'm going to do a post, and you watch Nightline. So, now if you're listening,
I'm going to post
that.
As I watch Nightline.
All right. That's it for us this week. I appreciate your time, and as always, podcast.autoblog.com. We are actually pretty much up to date and current on questions.
Just one thing before we go, Chris. I think we probably all want to just send our condolences out to John Neff's wife on the loss of her grandmother.
Yes, it was her grandmother. She was very close with him.
Yeah.
And,
so best wishes to Leanne. And,
all right. And ditto, definitely. And we will see you guys next week. Peace out.
All right. Night.